It's my pleasure today to be talking to William Graves in the house of Robert Graves in Daya. We are surrounded by beauty and also the most amazing amount of recent history, which William, I'm sure, is going to tell us all about. But William, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell us, now I believe that Robert Graves lived in this house where we're sitting on this wonderful terrace for 52 years of his life.
I'd have to work that out. He came here on to the island in 1929. He built the house in 1932. I guess moved in 1933. Left at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War in 1936. And I came back with him and his new family in 1946. And he remained here from 1946 to 1985. That was when he died in this house.
So you came back with him at that time. So where had you been before that then? Where was your life prior to here?
Well, it was a very young life. I was born in 1940 during the Battle of Britain. I was born in Devon. Went to kindergarten and sort of primary school near Brixham, a little village near Brixham, just down the road from Agatha Christie, who also lived around there, and in whose house I misbehaved, and that's another story. And then at the end of the Second World War, my father sent my half-sister Jenny over here to check whether it was possible to come back in. She came here. She wrote to saying, "Father, you can come back. Your pen, all your papers are just as you left it." So in the next 3 or 4 months, we came back, took an XRAF plane. It was called Hunting Services. Was the company that ran it, and it took us 2 days to fly down here, and we were the first civilian aircraft to land on the island after the war.
2 days. Where'd you go? Where have you been? Where have you been with this in this 2 days?
Well, we didn't go around flying around in circles. No, we landed. We left from Croydon Airport, landed at Rennes, where he had friends and where he had lived during his time away from Mallorca in 1938. Then we flew from Rennes down to Toulouse. In Toulouse, we had to get permission to fly into Spain. However, the pilot was a chap called Bleb, Captain Bleb, who had actually flown Franco from the Canary Islands to Morocco, where before he started Civil War, basically, and had a good record with the Franco regime, so we were let in with no problem. And then we flew down to Barcelona, and then from Barcelona we had to get permission to fly to Palma, and we arrived on the afternoon of May 26, 1946.
So that's five landings and five takeoffs to get here. Fantastic. But the idea that you could get into Mallorca because of who you knew, nothing much has changed, has it?
Well, it's always good to know the dictator, isn't it?
Yeah, I think to know the dictator is probably a very useful thing, yes, indeed. But how was your father's arrival back here greeted at that time?
Well, people came out from Palma to the airport to actually see us arrive. We were met by the chap that looked after the house for 10 years here in Daya. When we arrived, he drove us up here, and it's about an hour and a half's drive from the airport in those days. It was a little sort of dirt runway. The whole village was here to welcome us. So we came back to the house, and I was five and three quarters, I had a great time, and then we went to have supper, and other people came in and sort of kissed him and all the rest of it, and we took it from there.
So you arrived with your father, and who else then? Did you have other brothers and sisters that came back at that time with you?
Yes. To recap a little bit, Robert's first wife was Nancy Nicholson, with whom he had 4 children, and Jenny, who I mentioned, was the eldest, and my brother David was killed in the war in Robert's regiment in Burma, and 2 more brothers, a sister and a brother. And then an American poet called Laura Riding came on the scene, and they collaborated and sort of had a threesome and then a foursome and menage à trois and everything. And Laura Riding decided to jump out of the window, and we call that the defenestration. And of course, that was suicide, so they had to leave England. They met Gertrude Stein in Paris, whom they'd published a book for. And Gertrude Stein said, who'd been here before the war, said, if Mallorca is paradise if you can stand it, meaning it's paradise if you can sit down and work and not sit around in a cafe, which most people do still do nowadays. So anyway, I think that's the recap. Okay, and then eventually they had to leave at the beginning of the Second World War. He and Laura and a couple of acolytes that he had their hands hanging on, they went back to England, then spent some time in France. And Rennes was one of the places. That's where we landed. And then Robert was having better reviews than Laura, because Laura was also a poet. And then she decided she'd had enough of this and she was going back to America. So they all went back to America. She fell in love with the person they were staying with, dropped Robert, and Robert came back to England, met my mother, Beryl, and I was conceived and then born in Devon. So that's my life history until I got born.
Right, okay, so this is all becoming much clearer. So did Beryl come back with you here then?
So on the aeroplane was the pilot, co-pilot, Robert, Beryl, Lucia, Juan, and myself. I'm the eldest, then comes Lucia, and then comes Juan. And I have a younger brother, who's called Tomas, who was born in 1953, already on the island.
Right, so it was just a family relocation, just like many people are doing today then, except that you already had a house and a life and a reputation established before you arrived here. Your family did anyway.
It's a little bit more complicated because Robert couldn't get a divorce. Robert and Beryl couldn't get married, so Beryl changed her name by deed poll to Graves. So therefore, they came in as Mr. and Mrs. Graves into Spain, otherwise they wouldn't have been allowed in.
No, that's right. So how did that ever get regularised?
They got married in the British consulate here in Palma. Ivan Lake was the consul. They got married in 1951. And the wedding reception was on a wonderful ex-submarine mothership called the Rosalind. It was in the Club de Mar in Palma.
Yeah, yeah. So how old are you at this stage then? So you're a teenager then by then?
When they were married, yes. I'm on the bastard line until I was 11.
Is that a unique place to occupy?
No, because Lucia and June were also on the bastard line. Tomas is already a bona fide...
So Tomas was okay, but you three, did you go to the local Catholic school? And was this questioned here when you were in Dea?
No, because our name was Graves. There was no way to question, nothing to question. And they weren't going to show the papers, were they?
So you settled here then, and your life took... I mean, it can't really be normal with all that background, but you did go to school and you did exist in a day-to-day way like any other family, I presume.
Not like any other family, because the house was English, and we had all the English you know, we sat at the table. We had George and Silver. We had, you know, George and Candlesticks, Mallorcan furniture. We had the first pressure cooker in Mallorca, I guess. things like that. But on the other hand, I had my village friends, because I went to the village school, and we used to... I wrote a little book called Wild Olives, which I might as well plug here, which you can still get on Amazon. And but we used to go with them. We used to catch frogs from the water reservoirs and put straws up there behind and blow them up and take cats and tie tin cans to their tails, things that village boys do. But then came back to the house and stroked our cats and caressed them and listened to Dick Barton, Special Agent, on the wireless, as they were called in those days.
On the wireless. So what wireless did you have then? You had a wind-up world service?
No. In those days, there was no world service in those days. It was the BBC. BBC Home Service and, I guess, Light Programme, if that was there.
But did you need electricity for that?
We had an electric generator, which Robert bought the village, which is here in the garden, which you can see if you come to visit it. It was about, I don't know how many watts, it was about just whatever it took to run a valve radio. The water, the light was very dim. We sort of had about 25 amp watt bulbs and things like that. But we could, you know, it was enough to listen to the radio.
There's apocryphal stories about electricity in Deia, and it always comes back to your father, how the generosity of your father allowed this village in the mountains to have electricity supply when the rest of Mallorca didn't.
And twice over, because we had they had this generator which was run by a waterfall. It had been a flour mill, so he just put a turbine on it and ran it, and there were about, there can't be more about five or ten houses with it, with electricity. And it wasn't altruism. He wanted to be able to work at night, so he had enough work so he didn't have to work with a candle, by candlelight. He could actually work by electric light. And as the village grew, of course, the poor little generator, which is a tiny little thing in the garden, just couldn't manage. And they then tried to get to link up with the mains, and there was a lady, a countess in Valdemosa, who wouldn't allow the pylon, the electric pylon, to be put on her land. And eventually Robert, because he knew Fraga, who was the Minister of Education and Tourism in those days, who'd actually come to visit him here, well, that's another story. And he said, you know, what can you do about it? And he sorted it out, and we had electricity in 1963. So, but we didn't actually have mains electricity until 1963.
That's fantastic. But I'm just trying to get my picture here. I'm in this idyllic spot where you've got George and Silver, and you've got wonderful tablecloths, I'm sure, and you're running a very almost aristocratic English house in the middle of Deia, where everyone else is actually either scrabbling for a living if they were local, or living on the GI Bill if they weren't.
Well, it's hardly a mansion. It's a village house. All the houses, all the rooms are small. We had three studies when the house was built, and a press room, to say where the press was installed. Two of the studies were made into bedrooms, and the press room remained sort of as a library. And then we had just a couple of, but just a small bathroom and a toilet. That's all there was.
But there was little England in many other respects, though.
To a certain extent, we got the Overseas Times, which came in sort of very thin airmail paper, wrapped in a blue thing, which some old timers remember, and which we then used to wrap our oranges in the when we had too many, we crated up the oranges and wrapped them in the Times.
So how do you live as a child or a teenager in the overwhelming force that was your father and the way that his life happened here? I mean, where did the kids come in? Did you just have a great time, or was it difficult?
It was difficult. It was difficult, and we weren't allowed to make any noise. So much so that we had a wind-up gramophone, which had the steel needles, and to reduce the noise, I used to take rose thorns and stick them in the needle and play the 78 records with this thing, so that you could just hear it if you put your head near the thing. That was how we listened to when he was working. But we weren't allowed to make any noise at all.
Well, how did that work then? Did you just spend most of your time away from the house?
As far away as possible, yes. until in the afternoons, he went to get his post, or he went down for a swim. So, you know, then we could sort of more or less, but, you know, you had to be careful. If he was working, he just didn't make any noise.
And what happened if you did make a noise then?
You got a clatter around you. Yeah. Mm. Or at least got a good bollocking.
Yeah. And so your life then. So did you create your own world here then?
Well, I had my world in the village. You know, I used to go with the boys, go around fishing or down to the beach, and then of course when we were in Palma, I had my own friends in Palma, and as I grew up, we had a whole group of people here that used to come in summers, and we went down to Palma for the education. You know, so it was all right. It was you get to live. You know, it's a.
Well, when you're a child and you have no control over, because other people are controlling what you do, then you live within their confines. But when you were able to say, thanks very much, Dad, I'm off now, what did you do?
I got my, well, the first thing I did is at the age of 14, I was sent off to public school. I'd had a tutor, half tutor, first in Daya. The first tutor was called Bill Merwin. And one of my mother's college friends came here. It was called Eileen Isabel Hawking. Sorry, Eileen was our nickname for her. Isabel Hawking, who was Stephen Hawking's mother. And she came here with her children. And Stephen was shared my tutor with me. So I was tutored with Stephen Hawking and that actually was really quite a problem for me, because all Stephen could speak was English. And of course, all my contemporaries were Mallorcan. I'd go down to the village, and it was very embarrassing to have this English person that didn't understand anything, and all he didn't understand about sort of catching thrushes in nets and fishing and all the sort of things that people did then, and the sort of the agricultural cycle. It was embarrassing for me. In fact, it was embarrassing for me if I'm playing with my kids and my friends. And Robert came down to fetch me back for lunch or something. And, you know, he called to me, called out to me in English. And I sort of scurry away so he didn't, you know, so that I could sort of come round the back way and talk English to him without the village boys knowing. So I was living sort of a double life in a way.
So you were embarrassed by not his fame, but just the fact that he couldn't speak Mallorquin.
Exactly. Mm. Absolutely.
And Stephen Hawking's in your living memory is a disappointment to you because Absolutely. He couldn't speak Mallorquin.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, he was interesting. He liked sort of letting off stink bombs and things like that. Yeah.
How long did he live here then?
Only about 3 months. He was here about 3 months, but then you know, I've kept in touch with the family, and he mentions me in his book.
Of this idyllic summer when he was, he became the friend that...
He wasn't very impressed with William Merwin, Bill Merwin. And then after that, I went to move down to Palma, and my tutor was Martin Seymour Smith, who wrote a biography of Roberts. He came here, and generally it was someone walked through the door and they'd find a use for him. And when Martin walked into the door, he became my tutor. But the person that was actually came here to do something was his wife, his future wife, Janet Grenville, de Grenville, who had just done greats at Oxford and helped Robert with his Greek myths. So that was the reason. So it was, life here was very much whoever walked into the door was sort of put to use, sort of thing.
And did you have a pilgrimage of people coming to visit your father?
That started later on. You know, it started when, say, in the mid late 50s. But you know, we've had people like Ray Vaughan Williams came to visit us when we were in Palma. I was fascinated by him. He had a wonderful Bakelite hearing aid. I wasn't the slightest bit interested in I didn't know who he was as a child, but his hearing aid was what really impressed me.
And his music?
And his music. Then when I was sent to public school, then I realised
who he was.
But, you know, as a child, I had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, Robert was just my father. That was it.
And all the people that were living here at the time, I mean, when you read the books of that moment, I mean, you were sharing your space in the universe here with some incredibly clever and artistic people. I mean, there's a whole era that you lived through, but did they matter much to you?
It depended. I suppose from the age of 10 you started, so it was 1950, you started getting ex-GIs coming here. Or else people sent by friends in America. We had a chap called Tom Metcalf who was had won the Biennale in São Paulo in 1949 or something, and who was blacklisted as a communist by the Americans. So he had to live outside of things like that. You know, and we had sort of boat people again who were friends. There was a guy called Janine West and who used to get us our butane, because we couldn't get butane, but we had our first, we had a butane fridge. So, you know, that was brilliant having that. So there is a good connection with the boat community as well. And another person was the person who had the Rosalind, who had been an ex-submariner, Cyril Morrison, who used to charter boats in that early time. In Palma, so you know we always had a good connection with the Club Nautica. And of course, next to the Rosalind was the Thaka, Errol Flynn's boat was there. So you know there was a lot of, you know, there was that period of time when things were happening here, and Errol Flynn's wife used to go to ballet school with Nadine Gorham, I think. No, Nadine, I've got my name is. And then my sister went to ballet school with Ina Jansen, who was the other ballet teacher in Palma. So there's all this thing going on at the same time.
Well, you had whatever was going on in Dea, and particularly with the Americans and the GI Bill. Thank you to the Americans that sent us all there, sent all this talent over here. But, you know, at the same time in the Terreno and the places around Palma, you were having, you were just being visited by everybody. I mean, this place should have been the centre of the universe. And I think probably for a while it was.
Well, in Terreno, of course. No, Terreno lived its own life.
Yeah.
You had Larry's Bar. And everyone used to meet at Larry's Bar, and there was Robert Creeley and people like that were there, and it was another. But Robert had no time, you know. Mallorca was paradise for him because he could work. We had nothing to do with that whole world, apart from there was a pre-war painter called William Cook, who'd been a friend of Gertrude Stein. And so there was a connection still with Gertrude Stein after the war. And then there were some Americans called Cicely Foster and Archie Gittes. He was an American Jew. She was an English concert pianist. And they lived here in Dea during the war. In fact, they stayed right through the war. And there was some another English lady who stayed here during the war. But basically, Roberts kept a very small circle.
When you lived here, and it's probably only as you've got older and look back on it all that you realise the significance of the era that you lived in at that time.
When Robert died in 1985, a lot of biographies had already been written, so I wrote my book to set things right, so to speak, and that sort of gives a more appropriate vision of the of what life was like. And in fact, when my mother read it, said yes, that's how it was.
Well,
she hadn't read it yet.
That's the accolade
and
you need.
Of course, but anyway.
But we've got to go back now, because before we went off on this literary journey, we've only got to you being 14 and being sent off to school. So what happened to you then?
OK, I went to school, bottom of the class to start off with.
Were you in the UK?
I was at a public school in England called Oundle, near Peterborough. I was sent there because a broadcast called Cabby Marshall was the housemaster. Of course, he left the term I arrived. But one of the other boys he was already in the sixth form, was George Sassoon, who was Siegfried Sassoon's son. And of course, Siegfried Sassoon and Robert had both fought in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. So they had this, Robert and Siegfried met in front of my housemaster's study for the first time since he left England in 1929. So there's that little bit. And, you know, slowly I sort of got Englished, if you like. Learned silly mid-on and a few things like that meant. Actually, I can't remember what they mean now anymore. You learnt, and of course I had to learn the names of all the English footballers and people like that. You know, I was thrown into a complete new culture. You know, culture. I was like someone coming out of Addis Ababa or somewhere like that, and not knowing what the hell was going on. But slowly I built up, which allowed me to live more or less a normal life, and I managed to get out of school with five A levels, which is not bad. Of course, one of them was a mechanical drawing, but I decided to go up the science side, so you can't follow the Graves Act, the Robert Graves Act. So I decided to become a scientist and took geology, got an honours degree at Imperial College London, and worked in the oil business, oil industry all my life, apart from 5 years when I got married in 1966 with Elena, 1965, and ran a hotel for 5 years. But it was very useful, and I continued working through the thing, and then went and worked full time as a consultant in the oil business until I retired at the age of 68.
So your travels with the oil business then presumably took you all over the world, did it?
Always within flying distance of Mallorca, you know, because this was always my base, or wherever my wife and I have a son and a daughter, wherever they were, that was our base. And you know, then when we moved. They started off in Dea. We had a house in Dea. Then we moved to Palma and spent about 5 years there. And then they went to the Jesuits and the Sacred Heart, and we thought that was maybe not too wise. They were very young. And
they found religion.
They didn't actually find religion and couldn't quite understand what it was all about. But when Philip had to do his first communion, we gave him a watch anyway. And that satisfied him. And then we moved to Madrid, and they spent 5 years there. And then Philip went to his sixth form education in Uppingham, and then Imperial College. He's a mining engineer by degree, and eventually got an MBA. And my daughter is might as well go on this off on this tangent. And my daughter then went to King's and did math and education as a special needs teacher, and has been a special needs teacher ever since. So that's the family.
But you say that Mallorca has always been your base. So do your children regard that as their base, or are they settled in elsewhere now?
They're settled in England, in Putney. And but this is still their, you know, their home. Unfortunately, children always find their home and always have their own bedroom when they come back home, even when they get to 50.
Can you tell me a little of your relationship as you got older with your father?
Well, everything was fine, and in fact, you know, I was one of my most pleasant memories when I was working in Greece in the oil business, and he was asked to introduce that Standard New Jersey, the oil company, was doing a heritage series, and he was invited to introduce the Greek tragedies in Delphi. So I was actually working in Greece, so I managed to go and watch the filming of that. And I still have the film of that. But I was in very good terms with him. But he was already beginning to lose his memory at that stage. It started very early on. But I got interested in archaeology. So he said, why don't you go to Oxford and do archaeology? So I went to Oxford to do archaeology. So I left the oil business for a little bit, and then found someone else had written the same thesis. In fact, I'd got interested in archaeology also because Bill Waldron was here in the village, and I used to do digs with him. So, and I was going to do my thesis on the Bronze Age in the Balearics. That had been written, so I said, the hell with it. And I had a rather expensive French girlfriend at the time. I found Oxford at that stage was a bit puerile, having to have a green light on my car. So I came back here and then met Elena, my love life changed. And
tell us about Elena. She's Spanish, isn't she?
She's Spanish. I met her at the Club Náutico in Palma. A friend of mine, his father was the Comodoro in the Club Náutico. And they were arranging a Christmas dinner, a New Year's Eve dinner. And his son had several tickets for the dinner and said, why don't you come along, a friend of mine. And Elena had been asked to come along. And I sat next to her. I had another girlfriend at the time. But I sat next to her. She was wearing a Chinese silk dress, very short silk dress. Her brother-in-law had actually been one of the Flying Tigers in Taiwan, I guess, and had been Chiang Kai-shek's private pilot. Had been one of the original set up the Flying Tigers. So hence the Chinese dress. And Elena was living with Steve. Anyway, we danced together. She was smoking a Havana cigar. You know, it's always a good...
As you do.
As you do at Christmas parties. And so I went back to Oxford, I was still doing my archaeology, and I gave that all up as a bad job. Came back here. And then we met up, and we've been living together ever since.
The rest is
the rest of my life.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. How lovely. I need to bring you back here. I mean, would you say that you're a terribly respectable Englishman now?
No, I'm not sure I'm respectable, but still, there we go. I can play the Englishman, all right.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing.
Yeah. I understand playing the Englishman or the wild card or the bohemian or the. The Dea fix for being hedonistic. I mean, where do you fit in all that, though?
Well, okay. I was here in the 1960s. The drug scene arrived here. Everyone was, you went to a party and you were offered a joint. And I have never tried anything. I've never smoked anything more than a cigarillo until I got a bad cough and the doctor said, stop smoking. So I even stopped that.
What you mean the scene, the drugs and sex scene passed you by here?
I won't say the sex passed me by, but the drugs passed me by. and I've always been anti anything that influence. I guess it's being a scientist. I just like to keep my head and know exactly what's happening. Although I have to admit that every once in a while. Too much gin, because we used to play the guitar in a bar in Palma, some friends of mine, and got paid with I think little shots of gin. So every once in a while, you wondered how you drove back to Dea, but
Have you kind of reacted against your father's life then, in the sense of? It's kind of catalogued and well known about the different relationships and the muses that influenced him.
I stood up for my mother, and when it was just he was going off his head, and we all knew that, And but when it started that, in fact, okay, he had various so-called muses who he wrote poetry to. He had a prostate operation in 1958, so I don't think there's very much going on after that. So, but, you know, he might have, but anyway. So, you know, it wasn't that serious.
It was cerebral, but, darling, then, was it? Cerebral.
Whatever. But anyway, it helped his poetry, and that was the main thing. He got to this, his brain, he couldn't write any novels or anything like that. So it was everything, it was fairly short, I think. And his poetry, and he needed his poetry, and he needed that to keep himself sane. Well, fine. Okay, this is me rationalising. I wasn't rationalising earlier on because I didn't have the perspective. However, one day with one of his muses, he wanted me to drive him down, Elena and I, to drive him down because he'd been invited by Peter Ustinov, who was in Puerto Soler with his boat. And I said, you know, I'm driving you down, but with Beryl, not with this other one. And that was kind of a turning point.
How was your mother doing with all this then?
Well, stiff upper lip, but lots of migraines. Tremendous stress. And it was only when he was very badly injured during the Somme. We haven't mentioned this, but of course he fought in the Somme, badly injured, was in a coma for over. He was left. They did the triage. Oh, this one's not going to survive. Put him in a corner, lay him on a stretcher. It left him on the stretcher. They found him. He woke up from his he was in a coma. Woke up. Oh, Graves was still living. You know, we better take him down to the hospital. That was part of what happened. You know, part of his dementia. I think started his dementia. The second thing is he had Spanish flu. So when he was taken to Harley Street to see how he's, because Beryl realised he was losing his thing, and they did this the knee test. You know, if your knee your foot comes up, you're okay. If it goes down, you have some brain damage. He already had brain damage in 1966. So, you know, this was sort of thing. But and by 1970, she was starting to answer his letters. By 1975, he was no longer writing, and he lasted until 1985. So there was a long, long period where he was. And in his later years, his shell shock, because he was very, very badly shell-shocked when he first got married. And the shell shock came back, and when he was in a wheelchair, and it was some sort of noise, he started pointing at, you know, you could see his terror in his eyes. So he never got cured of his shell shock. He lived with it all his life. He didn't have the horrors that he had when he was first injured, but slowly, you know, it came back to him.
So, William, we're talking really about the tortured brilliance of your father, and it's a typical story in some ways that people were just so affected by the war influences that it's only in retrospect you can see exactly what formed them. But in all the brilliance and in all the words and in all the his legacy that he's left, I mean, you have now come into this legacy and you are taking his memory forward in this place. Tell us about the house and now how it's a museum and how people can come and see for themselves where it all happened.
Well, okay, the legacy starts actually when we read his will, and my sister's always, you know, been the writer and that sort of thing, and my brother Thomas had been to London School of Printing, so he was in printing. I was just a geologist. And then suddenly I find I am his executor.
You didn't know.
I didn't know I was going to be his executor, but it was just for the will.
Right.
But of course, he named no literary executor. So I just took on being the literary executor. So it meant that, okay, the first thing I had to do was set up, okay, his royalties and how was that dealt with? So I set it all that, set up a trust. So all the monies went to the trust. That's fine. And then someone said, well, you know, and I started looking at where all his papers were. And I went, there was a thing called the Register of English Letters and Manuscripts in Reading. So I went down to Reading to look at that, see what they had of Roberts. And I met one of the people on the board of the Samuel Beckett Trust. I said, Samuel Beckett Trust? Well, we need a Robert Grace Trust. So I set up a Robert Grace Trust at Oxford. So there's a St. John's College Robert Graves Trust to gather together all of his papers. And in fact, that's where all his papers, all his working library and all his papers were in this house are now at St. John's. We had a centenary conference at Oxford. We had a centenary conference here in Palma. We had a big exhibition in La Lonja, in this beautiful thing in Palma, in 1995. And we decided we should have a Robert Graves Society. So we had a Robert Graves Society. And then we started having international conferences. I'm just back from a conference in Oxford, Robert Graves in the First World War, at which we had two tremendous people, talking about military people. So we've got the military in there and all about post-traumatic stress and shell shock and all the rest of it. In this conference, I've also presented my latest project, which is transcribing all his letters he wrote during the First World War, which are now online. We have a Robert Graves lecture once a year now. In a month, I'm going over to England at the Sitwell's House, where we're having another lecture. But anyway, the conferences kept on going. My mother was here, still living in the house. She put together his complete poems, made sure that all his books kept back in print. His e-books are published everywhere. Worldwide, you can get them through, what are they called, Rosetta Books. Mm. If anyone wants to download them on board, now we're talking about to boat radio, they can be downloaded worldwide. And then in 2003, my mother died. I've already had the idea of sort of setting up a foundation here, but the local government sort of came and said, we want it. In fact, they actually came to us as we were lowering my mother's coffin into her grave, which wasn't the most appropriate moment. We'll talk about it. So we set up this foundation. The foundation was set up. The object of the foundation was to buy the house, and we opened in 2006, and we've been open ever since. We're open summer and winter. LaCasaDeRobertGraves.org is the website. No one knew anything about Robert Graves, and they bought the house. They didn't know what to do with it, and I was on the board, and I'm the only person that knew anything about Robert Graves. So it is as I describe the house, is as I remember it as a young boy. So I've got the old wireless where I listen to Dick Barton, Special Agent. I've got the old, the sort of coffee mill, the generators in the garden, everything that sort of ties in with the 1930s, 1940s. So everything is basically timed to that thing. All the electric light fixtures are original. All the furniture is original. One of the studies that was made into a bedroom back to the way it was. I had photographs of everything. I've got the plan of the garden, so it shows that it actually was exactly as it was in the 30s. And we get about 6,000 people a year, which is very nice.
I know that we're winding up but I'd love to talk to you again another time. But just tell me just the story of who is still looking for the Robert Graves story, the younger people. I mean, I can understand older people.
We're getting a lot of people now at the conferences that are looking at Robert Graves. People are interested in shell shock. There's a new selection of Robert Graves' war poetry. The first thing I did as his literary executor was to bring his war poems back into print, which he had wanted to forget about completely. He reckoned that goodbye to all that, which was his memoirs at the age of 33, covered the war, was enough to say goodbye to all that. And his war poetry, he also discarded. I brought the war poetry back into thing. So now now a new volume of his war poems, as they were originally published, with everything, with all the commentary, is coming out.
And we haven't even talked about I, Claudius. I mean, does that come into feature anymore? Are people remember in their memories?
A lot of people come into I, Claudius, to remember I, Claudius. And, of course, it's still shown. Still, people still remember it. And the BBC have the option for a new I, Claudius. So that, in the fullness of time, knowing how BBC works, will be produced, I hope. And otherwise, we'll just keep the option money, which is very nice. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we can all do with a bit of option money, can't we? Yes. Well, you know, as I say, I'm reluctantly winding up this interview because we've come to just one particular stage. There's so much more that you can say, and I'm so grateful to you that you've shared so openly with us exactly your life, and it's just been such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, and I hope we can be listened to worldwide. Indeed. On boat radio.
Thank you.
All the nice girls love a sailor. All the nice girls love a tar. For there's something about a sailor. Well, you know what sailors are. Bright and breezy, free and easy. He's the lady.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.